You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
if this was brought down, then those responsible must be held to account, and we must lose no time in doing that. It is an absolutely shocking incident. It cannot be allowed to stand. Until we know more, it's not really possible to say much more, but we'll be working very hard to get to the bottom of this.
As world leaders, David Cameron among them, express their outrage at the shooting down of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, we'll be devoting the entire first half hour to the disaster and its aftermath. The Independent's Mary Dejewski and the Evening Standard's Robert Fox will talk through what we know, what has happened since, and what might happen next. Also ahead, the great and the good of the football world may have packed their bags and left Brazil, and Brazil's team may have decided which wigs and false beards they'll be wearing the rest of the summer. But a little later in the programme, we'll check in our correspondent in Rio on life after the World Cup. And before the end of the programme,
the war, it's not what you want. There must be another way.
War has already begun.
We'll review the latest movie releases with Karen Krasanovich, and we'll also be talking about the major new exhibition on modern Middle Eastern art at New York's New Museum. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Lots coming up in the next 60 minutes, but ahead of all of that, the news with Jonathan Wheatley.
International investigators have arrived at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 after pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine allowed them access. Some 30 monitors arrived by helicopter at the scene near the village of Grabovo, where the plane carrying 298 people crashed on Thursday, near the regional capital of Donetsk, an area that is a stronghold of the rebels who've been fighting Ukrainian government forces. Well, the two sides in Ukraine's civil conflict have accused each other of shooting the jet down with a missile. The United Nations Security Council has just called for a full, thorough and independent international investigation into the downing of the plane, urging all parties to grant investigators access to the site after an emergency meeting in New York. The new British Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, welcomed the news.
This must be resolved by an international investigation to establish the facts of what has happened. We believe the United Nations, and particularly the United Nations Civil Aviation Organization, is the right body to lead that investigation, and we will provide it all the support we can, including technical support through the Air Accident Investigation Branch.
A statement from Malaysia Airlines said the aircraft had undergone and passed rigorous safety checks. It's the second disaster suffered by the plane this year after the mystery disappearance of flight MH370. Well, the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak said it's vital to locate the flight recorders to establish what happened.
We must and we will find out precisely what happened to this flight. No stone will be left unturned. If it transpires that the plane was indeed shot down, we insist that the perpetrators must swiftly be brought to justice.
Other news now, and an Italian appeals court has unexpectedly overturned Silvio Berlusconi's conviction on charges of abuse of office and paying for sex with a minor. In a significant legal victory for the former Prime Minister, the Milan court on Friday threw out a guilty verdict handed down last year by a lower tribunal which had sentenced Berlusconi to 7 years in jail and banned him from holding public office. Berlusconi was accused of paying for sex with former teenage nightclub dancer Karim El Marouk, better known under her stage name Ruby the Heart Stealer, during Bunga Bunga erotic parties at his palatial home near Milan. Israelis in Tel Aviv have today said they supported Israel's ground operation in Gaza, launched overnight. Israel intensified its land offensive in Gaza with artillery, tanks and gunboats and warned it could significantly widen an operation Palestinian officials said was killing even greater number of civilians. Rocket salvos, many of them intercepted by the Iron Dome anti-missile shield system, continued on Friday against southern Israel, police said, causing no casualties. Well, Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop has called for an immediate ceasefire.
Hamas have consistently and persistently refused to be part of a ceasefire. I condemn Hamas for refusing to put the interests of the Palestinian people above their own political ideology, and we call for a ceasefire immediately. Civilians are being killed, people are being injured. It is a spiralling situation.
Here, an unprecedented number of peers took part in Britain's House of Lords today in a marathon debate on the controversial issue of assisted dying. Around 130 put their names down to speak on a proposed new law which would allow doctors to give a lethal dose to terminally ill patients with less than 6 months to live. Critics say it amounts to licensed suicide and puts the frail, vulnerable and ill at risk of coercion. As the peers debated the bill inside Parliament, groups both for and against the proposed law protested outside. And finally, in the United States, a Kentucky man, already charged with shoplifting beer, added to his troubles when he made a prank call from the police station to order five pizzas, police said on Friday. Michael Harp, who's 29, had been arrested the previous night after shoplifting $36 worth of beer from a convenience store. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you, Jonathan. Enterprising fellow, he'll go far. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, 1807 in London, 1307 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Mary Dejeski, columnist with The Independent, Robert Fox, defence editor with The Evening Standard. Welcome both. We will be devoting the entire first half of today's show to the story of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, which sounds exactly like the kind of scenario you would conjure to give political science students a headache. Those culpable for the downing of the Boeing 777 over Ukraine have not been precisely identified, but a consensus is growing that it was shot down by Ukrainian separatists, at the very least equipped with Russian surface-to-air missiles. First of all, a roundup of what we've learnt today with our transport editor, Tristan McAllister, who also joins us. Tristan, what have we learnt today, especially this question about what the aircraft was doing there when other airlines had ceased flying over that area of Ukraine?
Well, first of all, Andrew, I think what we learned abundantly clear today was that the plane was indeed shot down by a surface-to-air missile. Of course, we heard that yesterday and started sort of trickling in, but then all of a sudden the Americans started to confirm it, and then we started to see sort of more and more reports of things on the ground that would lead us to believe that. So then beyond that, what we also know too is that there's a massive international interest in this story, because we are also learning about the manifests of this aircraft. And I think that is really one of the big linchpins in this story, because it means there are now so many different interests in this fight. Of course, the majority coming from the Netherlands, but also now we just learned in the last hour that there was also an American on board, there are Australians on board, there are Malaysians on board, many people from many more countries were on board. And so we now know that all of these countries will have an interest in how this plays out.
What are the legalities attending an incident like this, leaving aside how the aircraft may have been brought down? It is presumably largely Ukraine's direct responsibility, even if it is in a disputed territory of Ukraine.
Yeah, it is. The way this usually works is, and this, what we don't know is whether or not this will be treated as an act of war or it will be treated as a crime. And then in terms of jurisdiction, who will necessarily have jurisdiction over that? Now, in a typical situation, say there's a terrorist incident, usually it falls to the jurisdiction of the country in which the incident happened, which would be Ukraine. But now we're talking about disputed territory. So we move beyond that and we think, okay, well, who's really claiming the territory? We know Russia has really put a claim to the territory. So then are the Russians going to take this on? Well, it's really hard to know exactly how this will fall out. And then beyond that, will Russia just say, well, it happened in Ukraine, so the Ukrainians need to deal with it? And then beyond that, the authorities that want to get in on this, we already know, and according to President Barack Obama, We know that the NTSB is on its way, the FBI is on its way, and you can imagine that agencies from other countries are also on their way as well.
And will Boeing presumably want to send people as well?
Boeing has to know what's going on here, and beyond that, even if it wasn't an issue with the aircraft, forensically, people on the ground will want to work with Boeing engineers to know exactly how to piece things back together, because evidence has to be sort of controlled, and it has to be cataloged in a way that they can actually build a case were this to go to trial.
Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, thank you very much. Robert and Mary, we will start, I guess, with the immediate diplomatic manoeuvring. We've seen the UN Security Council today approve a statement demanding a full, thorough and independent international investigation, which I guess is more or less what you would expect the UNSC to say. Mary, I'll ask you first. We've seen Vladimir Putin calling for talks in Ukraine. Is he basically now just trying to wash his hands of this as fast as possible and get as far away from this as fast as he can?
Well, I think that's one interpretation. It's a perfectly plausible interpretation. I think there's something else going on in parallel, which is that he wants the world to believe that really he personally and Moscow had absolutely nothing to do with this. This wasn't because they had given any instructions or they'd given any encouragement, that this was something that happened with some rogue rebels that had nothing to do with Moscow. And I think so far Putin has really played it pretty much by the book. He has echoed the calls that have been coming from everywhere for international inquiries. He has pledged that if the black boxes fetch up in Moscow, he will return them to the international authorities. So I think so far he's being very keen to look as though he's complying with absolutely every dot and comma of the law.
Robert, is Putin basically in damage limitation mode here? Because we'll come to the other diplomatic and international reaction shortly, but his people are being extremely evasive. Sergei Lavrov, his foreign minister, is still insisting on blaming Ukraine for this. Their representative of the UN is attempting to point blame everywhere but Moscow. How successfully can Putin evade responsibility?
I don't particularly want to answer that question. I think that where I'm with Mary is I think that Putin is taking this actually on the face of things more seriously than Barack Obama is. And he realizes how really serious this is. You can talk about Lavrov and you can give me a whole lot of subclauses as you did in your question. And that is really damage limitation. I'm absolutely clear from the very first, and I've been watching this from the first 2 hours of this breaking, that Vladimir Putin, whatever you think about him, realizes this is really serious. It's a real, it could be a game changer, all the wonderful tabloid headline cliches, but he is really worried about this because he acutely is aware of, is he responsible for this ultimately? Because is it people under his command directly or indirectly who gave the weapons, who gave the orders, who gave the instructions, who gave the trainings that are responsible? Or are they people totally out of his control? It's a terrible vice that he's in. And he is aware of this. And this is why he's playing out of it. And the thing is that where he shows that he is a world-class statesman is he's saying, he's not blustering. He's saying, God, we've got to talk about this. And I think he really means this because he doesn't want this terrible ulcer to go on in that part of the world, which could destroy the Russian economy. It could certainly destroy within months the Russian money markets.
Can I just jump
Absolutely.
In here with one observation and a slight little bit of one-upmanship? Because I think Putin actually got a bad rap yesterday when he was interpreted as saying that this happened in Ukraine and therefore it was the responsibility of the Ukrainian authorities. What, as I understand it, he said in Russian was that it was the responsibility of the people in control on the ground. Now, that does not necessarily mean the people in Kiev. That means the rebels in the east of the country, given that the plane came down. And it also signals his dissociation from them as being clients and in control of Moscow. So I think that that's been a slight misinterpretation of Putin's original statement.
Robert, I'll come back to you on that point that you were making. Even if by the most charitable possible analysis, this was an either deliberate or accidental act by a militia with no line of control to Moscow whatsoever, is there any way Vladimir Putin can make global opinion believe that?
I think he can, because I take what Mary and I actually end up on the same side very much on this, because actually, forget the demonology, forget the Mail Online headlines. Actually, what Putin is doing is what a very reasonable man would do. He is actually discussing, arguing in the best Machiavellian sense, and there's a lot of good in Machiavelli, how you get through this, how you make this work. One thing that Putin doesn't want, he doesn't want war out of this. He doesn't want the thing to escalate. He doesn't want confrontation with the West, and he doesn't want further sanctions. What he is trying to do, and I love the messages going down to the frontier forces in Western Russia on the frontier, saying, look, get a grip of these guys. They've got this weaponry. They bought, begged, stolen, whatever, however they got it. They don't understand what it does. And what I really, and, you know, let's not be too cynical in a tabloid way about this. What I'm struck by about Putin, he does understand the moral side of this. He does understand the outrage of killing 298 civilians. Actually, that's the one thing where he and it's not cunning or whatever. He has got that across. He is genuinely shocked about it. And he genuinely shocked Obama with that. And Obama didn't know how to take it because he told him straight out what had happened.
And one can only assume that Putin is thanking whichever god he prays to that they didn't hit a Chinese or an American or an Indian aircraft.
Well, that, hit with 151 Dutch on board, and I think that's going to be very serious.
Well, indeed. But Mary, all that notwithstanding about the way Putin has approached that, how then do we account for the amount of flak that his subordinates are still putting up?
No, I mean, I agree with an awful lot of what Robert has said. But one thing I don't agree, which is that I think that Putin has a colossal problem. He has a colossal image problem, because regardless of what we think about how he's handled it, looking at the small print and looking at his actual demeanour. On the other hand, the way that it has been interpreted practically everywhere, certainly in America, in Britain, in the tabloid press, the headline on the Sun, the front page, the whole of the front page this morning had a gigantic headline which said Putin's missile. And this is what people accept. And it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for him to deflect all that.
Okay, well, we'll move along now to where this does leave the conflict between Ukraine and the Russian-backed separatists. Robert, I'll ask you, this has to be the end for the Donetsk People's Republic, doesn't it?
No, I absolutely agree with you, because I think this is again where Mary is a far more distinguished journalist than I am. I'm being serious about this. You have to deal with sources. We've picked up the traffic. We've had the tweets. Actually, it's very interesting. In my other life, I was a medieval historian where you deal with chronicles, as Mary has done in probably Russian studies, and they're dead unreliable. But they will give you flashes of insight. And some of the sheer quality of the exchanges between the commanders. And I have read transcripts of at least four or five commanders. By golly, they do understand that they screwed up. They do understand this is a terrible mess. Actually, that's one good thing. Everybody, yeah, I'm not with the Mail Online. I'm not with it on the Sun. You know, good guys, bad guys, white hats, black hats. These are people still au fond, who belong to a society, who belong to a community, and may seem bizarre to us, have a moral compass, and they do realise this is a terrible mess. And actually, one or two of them said, look, we can't go on like this.
Mary, could they be the first rebel movement ever to have embarrassed themselves into non-existence?
Well, I dare say there may have been some before, but it certainly looks as though this is what's going to happen. That if Putin really had very little control of them before, he now has almost the opposite. He actually wants shot of them. And I think you can actually look over the last month and a half since the elections in Ukraine, that what's been happening is actually a seeping away of support for the rebels in the East. And the problem is that in proportion as that support seeps away, then those rebels get more desperate and look to even more desperate remedies to consolidate what they think is their cause, to have a separately governed Eastern Ukraine. And it seems to me that even though this was clearly a mistake, nobody intended to shoot a civilian airliner out of the sky. But this has really established that this is the end for them. They're not going to get any international support, even from the few friends who remain. So, yes, I mean, I think it's over for them.
I mean, just a final thought on this, Robert. Does Poroshenko at this point, sitting in Kiev, now have an implicit blank check to go and actually quite seriously sort the rebels out, or does he not even need to do that?
No, he mustn't go mad. He must leave it for others, because I think that Putin will make an offer. And I hope the back channels, I'm sure they're working very, very powerfully on this. And I think a figure like Angela Merkel, who speaks his language, is going to be very important in this. And what the deal would be, of course I accept that Ukraine must be sovereign and independent and possibly look to the West, but I want it to be neutral and I want you to give a certain kind of autonomy. And it may well be a hopeful model for the future in the predominantly Russian-speaking areas where they look like. And that's where, you know, out of a very, very bad thing, something quite good may come. Because as Mary said, one of the extraordinary things about it was actually, I'm sorry to use the language on this thing, the number of expletives deleted, the oh shit, oh God, we have really screwed up. Not one of them thought it was a good thing. Of the five commanders whose transcripts, they may be bogus. I don't think they are, curiously.
They sound looking at maybe, you reasonably know, plausible.
And they think that this is a really, really bad deal. I want to put in one footnote for Mary's and my trade. I tell you who the real heroes of this are. And it's in a very grim and awful world. It's those independents working for the agencies, particularly not necessarily for the newspapers, for Agence France-Presse, for Reuters, and for the Associated Press, who got on the ground and, you know, without moral spin, they said what they had seen. And as a colleague was saying on a discussion show that Mary and I were on early this morning from Defence Intelligence, he said that is infinitely better than anything you'll get from a spook, from a paid-up intelligence agent, from MI6, the CIA, the SBU, or God knows what, because it is open, it is clear, it is timely and precise.
We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. When we return, we'll consider the international implications of the downing of MH17 and looking at what might happen next.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
And welcome back to Midori House. Still with me is Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. Now, the MH17 story is obviously an international headline, but it's also one in which many nations have a deeply felt stake. Among the 295 presumed dead are 189 Dutch citizens, 44 Malaysians, 28 Australians, 12 Indonesians and 10 Britons, plus victims from Germany, Belgium, the Philippines, Canada, New Zealand and the United States. The leaders of all of those countries have reacted with predictable and quite proper fury. We would talk Talking earlier about Vladimir Putin's reaction immediately, how does he play this long term? Mary, I'll ask you first. Putin is due at the G20 summit in Australia in November, where he's unlikely to be a terrifically popular guest. According to Treasurer, though, Joe Hockey, there are no plans to disinvite him at this point. Should there be?
I think probably not, because I understand why Putin has been sort of exiled from the G8, which has restyled itself back as the G7, because that was all about Ukraine and Europe. G20 is much more, I think, Russia's territory, and Putin is much more among friends and, to an extent, sort of equals. And so I think it would be much more useful for the others to have Putin there as well as for Putin to be there. And, of course, it wouldn't come amiss for him actually to hear their opinions firsthand.
Robert, is there anything too big? I mean, there is, you know, predictable and quite reasonable outrage around the world. Is there anything actually to be gained by beating Russia up further over this?
No, absolutely not. There are plenty of things, but there are nations, and I speak with some feeling and with prejudice, that I think are very important. And I think nations like the Big Four in Europe have ignored at their peril. And I would speak up for the Dutch, the Swedes, the Benelux, but particularly the Dutch. The Dutch are a very serious country. I know this from personal experience. I have a very serious wife for 41 years, and we have an Anglo-Dutch family. My heart bleeds for those people. They were going to an AIDS conference. They put more in than they get out of Europe. And the insouciance, it's actually not of Putin. The thing that infuriates me is the insouciance, and personally, as a journalist of 47 years, is the insouciance of Obama. Obama was supposed to be Mr. Cosmopolitan Global President. He barely flecked an acknowledgement of this because he didn't know how to. It's actually a George W. Bush moment of 9/11, his reaction to this. The Dutch, I think, who are very, very shaken indeed by this, have actually, Rutgers must be congratulated in a way that I think I respect. I respect what Putin has done, because it's a very serious trauma for that country. They have all the instruments at their disposal to do what it is, and they could press a class suit of a war crime, a war crime against their citizens, and they have the facilities on their own territory in The Hague.
Indeed they do.
And we're going to hear about this. These people really count. And of them, a great team was going to an AIDS conference, and probably one of the very greatest AIDS scientists and pioneers in the world. Now, it's interesting. The BBC headlines, your headlines, the Reuters headlines, the CNN headlines, it's all bloody America and Russia and this, that, and the other, and it's nobody in between. And in that headline, there is an implicit sneer about the Swedes, the Italians, the Dutch, the Belgians, the Danes, with whom I have worked for half of my working life. These are serious countries. These have a serious culture. These have a serious political imperative. And now is their time, because it's going to be very, very important in all this. Forgive my rant, because I'm quite emotional about this. And, you know, this is where the news agenda in the Anglo-Saxon world has just got it wrong.
Mary,
and I think it's going to count with Putin. Funny enough, I think Putin realises this.
Mary, what have you made of the reaction of President Obama especially? He spoke earlier today in quite clearly self-consciously, I think, everybody keep calm mode. He did make reference to the 100-odd AIDS advocates and investigators en route to Melbourne. The trouble is, as Robert was saying, that there's possibly nothing to be gained by outright belligerence at this point. Is he basically trying to figure out what happens next, same as everybody else?
I think he is trying to figure out what happens next. I think he also feels a huge burden of responsibility, in part because he's been criticised for showing insufficient world leadership at home, but also, I think, because he understands that this is an occasion where one wrong step and one wrong word actually brings you very close to war, close to world war. And he, I think, believes deep down that what happened is not worth a world war. But I don't think he quite understands where to go next before he has more information. I think it's also rather an American moment, that Americans are really not good at, as it were, shared experiences with Europeans and other nationalities. Obama maybe is better than some Americans we've seen. He is much more culturally sensitive. Probably the best of all was Bill Clinton. Yeah. But I think that it was a moment, as Robert said, the response from Obama and from America was very America-centred, very US-centred, as though the majority of the people on that plane had not been Europeans and Southeast Asians. The Europeans and the Malaysians, of course, who learned after the last the plane that disappeared, the Malaysians have learnt their lesson on how to present things. So I think in some ways, it will be interesting for scholars of the future to analyse the response to this, to what happened, because it is a sort of microcosm of international manners.
A final thought from each of you, and unfortunately a brief final thought from each of you as time is against us. I'll start with you, Robert. Whose move is it now?
I think it's Obama and I think it's Putin, and they realise it. But I think what is so worrying for Obama is that Putin's EQ, emotional quotient, has been so much better than this. I agree with, and I'm sorry I went over the top about this, but I don't apologise for it if I upset people. I think it is a real turning point. It is one of the two or three major turning points post-Cold War. I do think they will keep it under control. I do not think the world is going to conflict. It is a very serious moment, but it is the people that we don't expect. And I suspect that the crucial player is not going to be Obama or Putin in this. I think it's going to be Angela Merkel.
Mary?
I think I'm going to give the boring answer, because I think it's going to be the UN and international cooperation and the international air regulators and people who investigate these things. And I actually think they're going to be allowed to do their job, and they're going to be encouraged by Obama and by Putin and also by the Europeans, and that there is going to be a degree of solidarity over this, which maybe we haven't seen on a lot of occasions before.
Mary Dejewski, Robert Fox, we will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo,
to Shanghai,
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Buenos Aires,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We will be reviewing the latest movie openings and speaking to the curator Massimo Gioni on a new exhibition of Middle Eastern art at the New Museum in New York City. Before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley is here with the headlines.
Thank you very much. International investigators have arrived at the crash site of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 after pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine allowed them access. Some 30 monitors arrived by helicopter at the scene near the village of Grabovo, where the plane carrying 298 people crashed on Thursday. An Italian appeals court has unexpectedly overturned Silvio Berlusconi's conviction on charges of abuse of office and paying for sex with a minor in a significant legal victory for the former Prime Minister. The Milan court today threw out a guilty verdict handed down last year by a lower tribunal which had sentenced him to 7 years in jail. Israelis in Tel Aviv have said that they support Israel's ground operation in Gaza launched overnight. Israel intensified its land offensive in Gaza with artillery tanks and gunboats and warned it could significantly widen an operation there. And here, an unprecedented number of peers took part in Britain's House of Lords today in a marathon debate on the controversial issue of assisted dying. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House live here on Monocle 24. It is 21:33 in Moscow, 18:33 here in London, 14:33 in Rio de Janeiro, which is exactly where we're going right now. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, and today it is the turn of our woman in Rio, Sheena Rossiter. Sheena, welcome to the programme. Brazil recovering from the World Cup, and I guess let's start with that, because have people stopped talking about the semi-final yet? Are they trying to pretend it never happened?
Yes. Hi there. So that is a very good way to put it, that Brazil is recovering from the World Cup, because that has actually been dominating the headlines. Even though various things have been happening here in Brazil, the main topic, the main thing that is dominating the headlines is basically Brazil football in crisis. So basically, earlier on this week, Luis Felipe Scolari did step down after such a poor performance from the national team during the World Cup, namely after the 7-1 loss to Germany, which ultimately did go on to win the World Cup. So I guess that's the silver lining to this. At least they lost so badly to the World Cup champions. But basically, that has been the main headlines, and that's what everybody is talking about, is that Brazil football is in crisis, and this is a major cultural point, not just for Brazil, but also a major soft power point for Brazil, because Brazilian football is synonymous with the word Brazil and the identity that Brazil has. So a lot of former football players have been speaking out, saying that basically Brazil should be exporting less of its players to Europe and retaining more talent at home, because Brazil exports more football players than any nation around the world, and that basically there needs to be major restructuring within the CBF.
Has anyone had any brilliant ideas about how clubs like Fluminense are going to come up with Real Madrid wages?
Well, that is definitely another problem that these Brazilian teams definitely face, not to mention the fact that there is definitely endemic corruption within the Brazilian Football Confederation, the CBF, and within these football clubs itself. So obviously, Brazil needs to be able to kind of manage these teams more like a business, be able to get more sponsors in order to be able to come up with these wages. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, no, Brazil will never be able to pay the wages that teams like Real Madrid pay their players.
Well, there was some talk, especially outside Brazil during the World Cup, of whether what effect a Brazilian failure to win it could have on Brazil's politics. But according to a recent poll, Dilma Rousseff isn't doing that badly.
Exactly. So in a poll released today by Datafolha, which is associated with Folha de São Paulo, the largest newspaper here in Brazil, President Dilma Rousseff currently holds about 36% of the vote ahead of the October 5th election. She is ahead of her PSDB rival, which is Eiko Neves, who has 20% of the vote, and the PSB candidate, Eduardo Campos, who is holding just 8% of the vote at the moment. And this is with 13% of Brazilians undecided on which way they are actually going to vote. That's up from 11% of Brazilians a few weeks ago that said they were undecided. And 10% of Brazilians have said that they will just leave their votes blank, that they will not vote for any candidate. So as it is right now, Dilma Rousseff, the current president, will go to a second round. And if it does go to a second round, she is also expected to win, according to the Datafolha poll.
Also, Dilma Rousseff has recently been in the news not just for getting booed at the World Cup, but also for chairing the BRICS summit, which did actually come up with something. It does appear to have stopped just being a talking shop.
Yes, exactly. So the sixth Brazil summit was held in Porto Alegre, Brazil, on July 15th, just 2 days after the World Cup ended. And it was a 48-hour summit that did make some major moves, as you just mentioned. One of them was the inauguration of the $50 billion U.S. dollar development bank and the $100 billion U.S. dollar panic fund for troubled debtors. So this is kind of showing a big move, not necessarily these moves here at the BRICS summit for Dilma Rousseff and the Brazilian government isn't necessarily going to help her in the federal election in October. But what she was looking to achieve with some of these moves, along with her counterparts from Russia, India, China, and South Africa, was that she wants to move Brazil forward to be from a middleweight power to a heavier hitter in terms of global and economics, global economic politics. So basically, she is looking to move this forward with Brazil being a bigger player on a global scale. But it's hard to say if that will be actually developed into something, because the BRICS summit tends to not be taken as seriously as it should be. But with the moves that they made at this recent summit with this development bank, people will definitely be watching closely to see what this development bank can actually accomplish.
Sheena Rossiter, thank you for joining us. That was Sheena Rossiter in Rio. Up next here on Midori House, we'll speak to the curator Massimo Gioni on the new museum's new exhibit of art from the Middle East.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, MH17 notwithstanding, the news over the last few weeks has been dominated, not for the first time, by internecine violence in the Middle East. One of the many sorry side effects of a solid few decades of this sort of thing has been a perception elsewhere in the world that chaos and hatred are the region's sole produce. Hoping to redress the balance is a new exhibition showing at New York's New Museum. And earlier, I spoke to the curator, Massimo Gioni.
That was one of the questions we discussed throughout the preparation of this show. First of all, we also tried to be a little more specific and not talk about the Middle East as a generic term, but more about various Arab countries. And in a way, we looked less at current events and more at the position of the artist, the responsibility of the artist in the face of history. So yes, there are references to the Arab Springs, there are references to the wars in Lebanon, there are plenty of references to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but most importantly, I think we're looking at artists taking on the role of storytellers, taking on the role of interpreters of their time. And so paradoxically, even though there is a lot of current events in the exhibition, what you also get to see more and to learn more about is the interior life of the artist and the way in which they speak in a first person singular, and they take on the role, whether they like it or not, of trying to interpret and untangle the world around them.
You have made a very important point there, which is that there is a tendency in Western media coverage especially to report on the Middle East or the Arab world as if it is a monolith, which is obviously as absurd as thinking of Europe as one place, or even you could say the United States of America as one place. They are extraordinarily diverse entities. How did you guard against that? Did you go out of your way to select artists from many different and diverse countries?
Well, there are 45 artists in the exhibition, and they come from 15 countries. Many of them are active both locally and internationally, and the exhibition is titled Here and Elsewhere, and from the very title, which is actually borrowed from a movie by Jean-Luc Godard, we wanted to stress that, yes, it is an exhibition about various places in the Arab world or in the Arab worlds, but also, as Godard says at the end of his movie, it's by looking elsewhere that maybe we learn also at new ways to understand our here. And one of the main preoccupations of the show, which makes it, I think, more specific, is that many of the artists in the show are interrogating images, and they are questioning whether or not images can be bearer of truth. So at the core of the show, it isn't just that the Arab world, but more specifically is an interrogation about how do we represent truth, how truth is constructed, how ideology is constructed through images. And that helped us being more focused. And then secondly, we also tried in the very spatial organization of the show to try and focus on specific scenes in specific cities or geographical areas, so not to just create a giant melting pot, but sort of zooming in on various realities.
Having acknowledged that the Middle East or the Arab world is many different countries containing many different points of view, that notwithstanding, do you think or do you notice from this collection a kind of Arab vernacular, if you will, distinct from what might be immediately recognizable as European or American art?
Well, yes, but it might be that is our perspective more than we didn't want to claim that there is one style or one voice. I think what we did bring together in this exhibition is this reflection on truth in images. And that means many of the works deal with the problem of the documentary and the reportage. It might be a generalization, but I do believe that many of these countries have been under such scrutiny by mainstream media that many artists react by saying, look, let me tell you how I see it, or let me tell you this story in a way that maybe it's not the way in which CNN has reported on it, or the way in which the BBC or Al Jazeera. So there is a desire to take on media in a first person. And that, again, I don't know if it's a style, but certainly is an attitude that I believe is a reaction against this surplus of media representation. And then throughout the show, there is also a confessional tone. We have spoken about personal reportage or sentimental documentary to describe some of the videos and images that appear in the exhibition, which often mix reality and fiction, and also throughout the show, I think there is a very touching use of drawing in a sort of, again, confessional mode, which to us was another strong surprise. No, you associate the idea of truth in a way with photography, with video, but then we witness in the work of many artists this desire to use the most basic of medium, which is drawing, not just a piece of paper, a pen or a pencil, as though those tools are the ones that connect most immediately to the emotional landscapes and to the interior life of the artist. So I think that is a recurrent element in the exhibition, is this tension between the individual and the collective, and the individual finding his or her own voice to talk about the collective world around them.
And that was Massimo Gioni, Artistic Director of New York's New Museum. Here and Elsewhere is showing until September 28th. It's time now for a bit of music, and persisting with the theme of great modern Middle Eastern art rising out of chaos, this is Rashid Taha with Rock El Kasbah. One of the greatest cover versions ever recorded by anybody ever, Rashid Taha with his take on The Clash's Rock the Kasbah. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Coming up for 1851 in London, time now to review the arts, the best, sometimes the worst, in the worlds of television, theatre, book, cinema, etc. Today we are talking film once again with Karen Krasanovich. Karen, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you. I used to be the resident. Can you call me resident? Because I like
our
that.
Our resident film Great. Critic, feel better Karen now. Krasanovich. I mean, anything you like, really. Resident film critic, deputy sheriff.
Superb.
First Lord of the Admiralty.
Take that. It's a little hot for that suit.
Okay, yeah. Okay. We are talking film with yeah. First Lord of the Admiralty, Karen Krasanovich. First of all, it is the beginning of the dawn of the planet.
I know
of
what
the,
you're thinking.
How many of these have there been?
There's been seven.
Planet of the Apes films.
Yeah, because there, I just did a film. That was one of the questions on the Critics Circle Summer Party Film Quiz.
I lost count at one, frankly. Yeah. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, yes. Starring Gary Oldman and God's Gift to headline writers Andy Serkis.
I know. I can feel your resistance to
well,
this.
No, well, no, I'm resistant, and yet I'm resistant because, you know, really, how many of these things do we need?
I know.
However, in the notes you have compiled and with which I have been provided, the phrase apes on horses with guns appears. So I'm thinking... Okay.
Can't be that bad.
I'm willing to give it a chance. Apes on Horses with Guns. Promising start. Where do we go with
Thank
that?
Thank you. I was very resistant to this, too, because I'm thinking, great, I'm just going to look up and see a bunch of monkeys with a lot of, uncanny valley. You know what that is. When the CGI goes wrong and there's a smearing and things look wrong and you feel queasy in your stomach and you think, this is a synthetic creature I'm looking at. This is not real. This seems real. And the story is really good. I would bet you that if you went to see it and you didn't like it, I would give you some money. I would pay for your ticket because I was very, very resistant to this film. I thought, I don't care if it doesn't have Charlton Heston in a thong. I really don't want to see it. Okay, I'm old, but never mind. Andy Serkis teams with a group of very, very skilled actors to be very, very convincing as apes. And because the script is so good, there are so many layers to this, and it's fast, and it pulls you in. And I'm just stunned how good it is, really. It's by the director, Matt Reeves, who did Let Me In and Cloverfield. He's got a good pace. He handles dark and shade and light really, really well. Trust me.
Okay, well, notwithstanding the fact I would pay money to go and see a film of actual monkeys on horses with guns.
They look real.
And indeed, that actually is a live spectacle. Somebody should do a theme park. But we do have a clip of Planet of the Apes Part Umpty Hundred.
Are you aware they are going to turn on you?
They don't want a war.
No, don't shoot!
Caesar, you have to go.
Go. Where?
Apes! Together! Strong!
War, it's not what you want. There must be another way.
War has already begun.
Well, apparently. Planet of the Apes Part 7, we decided, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't seen the first six. I worry that I wouldn't be able to catch up. We will move along to I Am Divine. Mm. This is a... it's about Divine. Divine the artist. Perhaps, before we get to the film, if you could give people a brief précis of Divine.
I will try. If you're aware of John Waters' films, in most of his films, there was a very, very... large, obnoxious, outrageous transvestite called Divine. He's actually was a man called Glenn Milstead from Baltimore, who was a gay man in a time when being gay wasn't that easy, and being heavy wasn't that easy, and being a transvestite wasn't that easy. He broke a lot of barriers because he was actually a very talented person. And this is the documentary about his quite short life. Now, again, like with Planet of the Apes, I thought, you know, I know all about Divine. I really don't want to know because she's really this character. Divine is a persona, is famous for one thing, really.
One of the more infamous scenes in cinema history.
Probably the most infamous scene in history. But it involves eating canine excrement. I mean, actually, this wasn't fake fudge. This was real. But you have to look beyond that. You really do, because this documentary will suck you in and show you that this person has actually changed how we look at cinema, not just cult cinema, but movies in general.
And more to him or stroke her than
huge
than canine coprophilia. We do have a clip from I Am Divine.
The pediatrician told me that Glennie was more feminine than was masculine.
He got beat up every day at school.
I was very uptight about my weight and about the way I looked.
When Divine finally did go out, he met gay people, and then he went out with a vengeance. Divine was breaking the rules of drag and defying them by wearing stuff that a fat person would never wear.
That is I Am Divine, Jeffrey Schwartz's documentary, Recalling Divine. Is it worth... I mean, most things in which John Waters talks are worth seeing.
Oh, yeah.
And this is worth it, John Waters talking plus other stuff as well?
Yeah, I think Jeffrey Schwartz has been working in the cult and TV area since 1993. He really knows his stuff. This is really fast-paced. It tells you probably a little bit more than you need to know, but actually at the end of it, when you find out that Divine does pass away, and not in a typical way either, you're really sad.
Okay, well, just finally, we need to talk about another documentary. This is the Finding Vivian Mayer. Mm. If I pronounce that right, or is it Mayer?
I think it's Mayer.
Finding Vivian Mayer. The fact that, the very fact that we can't tell whether it's Mayer or Mayer tells us about that she was a somewhat overlooked figure.
Completely overlooked. Completely. This was a woman worked in Chicago as a nanny in the 50s and 60s, was an obsessive camera bug. She would take pictures of everything. Now, that's not uncommon, particularly now, but this is before digital. She passed away in 2009, and John Maloof, who was an estate agent, actually, was looking for some pictures for history he wanted to write. He bought about 100,000 negatives, had started having them developed, and discovered this amazing street photographer.
It sounds like the stuff of an extremely corny fictional film.
Yes, and it is a little bit because Malouf owns the copyright on all of her stuff because she's dead and she has no family, or as far as I know. And so he teams up with Charlie Siskel, who's very expert in this kind of documentary area. And it's a very pacey, a little bit chilling documentary.
That's Finding Vivian Mayer. Karen Krasanovich, First Lord of the Admiralty and resident film critic, thank you very much for joining me. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Matilda Ivy. Our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines, we have The Menu with Marcus Hippie. At 2200 hours, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. This show returns on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, thanks for listening.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam,
a Bogota,
to Hong Kong,
all around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.